It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, our guest breaks down the myths and realities behind the so-called rise of Asian Americans.
First, estimates released today from the United States Census Bureau show that one of Milwaukee's most persistent problems isn't getting better.
The city's poverty rate sits at 29%. That's unchanged from a year ago. And it's still significantly higher than the national rate of about 15%. That puts Milwaukee as the nation's fifth most impoverished big city. So when it comes to fighting poverty in Milwaukee, what's working, what's not, and what else needs to be done?
Here with us now to try to answer some of these questions is David Pate. He's an associate professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee and affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty. David, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
Thanks for inviting me.
So we've got the stubborn 29% poverty rate in Milwaukee for the year of 2014, and hearing that it's unchanged since last year, what was your first reaction?
My first reaction was that I wasn't surprised because I've seen that over time there's been a number of issues that have affected particularly black families in Milwaukee, but particularly black men, which is the area of work that I've done for the last 20 years. Some of the things that I've seen that have been significantly affecting these men is just their lack of access to any type of job that's going to enable them to take care of their families, and if they're single, take care of themselves. So I wasn't totally surprised, but at the same time, I know there's been some initiatives to do some to make some differences in the city, but I think that because this problem has been so persistent and has a historical historical presence to it, it makes for a difficult issue to solve.
You mentioned jobs as being a persistent issue as part of this package here, but what about some of the other routes, maybe the decline in manufacturing, for instance?
Yeah, well, for the last four decades, we've seen a significant lack of jobs availability. And one of my colleagues at UW, Mark Levine, who has done a lot of work on this particular area, has expanded beyond what we call the employment rate or unemployment rate to look at joblessness. And so because of the last four decades of manufacturing moving out of Milwaukee and also the issues that confront these men around the issues of incarceration, which we haven't talked about, Milwaukee has some significant interaction between those two. When you have a high rate of incarceration, that being that 50% of black men have been incarcerated in Milwaukee, your chances or your opportunities for work are just much less available to you.
Now, when you start looking at these figures closely, the striking thing is these stark racial disparities. Poverty rates, for example, among non-Hispanic whites, that's a 15%. Among Hispanics, 32% going up. And among African Americans in Milwaukee, 40%. How do you account for those stark racial disparities?
You know, again, we have to look at how has history allowed this particular group in Milwaukee to be able to be employed, but also some of the newer data that we're receiving, and this is, again, a report from EPI at UWM, has looked at the incarceration rates, and I think we really have to have some real discussion and real understanding of how, one, the lack of job availability, much of what William Julius Wilson talks about a lot in his work, is that when work disappears in any given community, and particularly for men, and unfortunately, we live in a society where men are provided with a lot higher pay rate than women. Women still get paid 78 cents on the dollar compared to men. And if you look at black men, they're not employed. And so therefore, you're leaning on a population of people where, if you gendered this whole discussion and women are the ones who are carrying the communities, there's not as much income coming into communities. There's not as many high-paying jobs. Therefore, we have allowed, or unfortunately, we have a system or a group of people who are not able to still reach the American dream or have the opportunities to do that. And for Latinos, who I don't know a whole lot about, but I do know they are still within this population of minorities who are just confronted with what jobs are available to them that's going to enable them to take care of their families.
Now, Mayor Tom Barrett talked to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and he said, look, we do have some jobs programs that are ongoing, jobs that are funneling people from prison into jobs to transition. He said he's been urging people to go into construction jobs, some of these development jobs that are there, and that there is effort going on, but yet this number is still sitting there at 29. So what does that tell you about the mayor's initiatives so far, the city's initiatives?
I think the mayor's plans are well intended. I think he is, of course, trying to tackle something that's very difficult. However, when I look at these programs, and I've been doing research with some of these workforce development groups for the last 3 years, these men present with a lot of issues that are just not, I need a job. There's a lack of housing available to these families. So therefore, if you don't have a place to live and you can't wash yourself on a daily basis or comb your hair or brush your teeth even, you can't get a job. And so housing is a significant issue for these very low-income families that I talk to, particularly Black men and Latino men. The other things is that these jobs also have what we would call a social network or a job referral. If anyone wants to think about their own way of getting a job, it's generally through someone they know or somebody who's been made the referral for them. But if your group of people you work with are primarily people who are also unemployed, you don't have very many people who can refer you to a good paying job.
We're talking right now with David Pate from UW Milwaukee and an affiliate on the Institute for Research on Poverty. We're talking about the latest poverty statistics in Milwaukee. Milwaukee at a rate of 29% for the second year in a row. And the numbers not encouraging when you look at the past 6 years or so. Now, we're hearing about a boom in construction in Milwaukee along the downtown, and that, look, there's a renaissance here going on. So why hasn't that then trickled down to the rest of Milwaukee in general?
I wish I had the answer to that one. I really do. And I'm not trying to be flip about this, but I really don't understand why there are so many jobs or what appears to be a lot of growth going on in Milwaukee. However, the people who look and present as and who have these significant issues and challenges in the city are not getting those jobs. One, for a variety of reasons. A lot of these men may be fearful of coming out of their communities to do the work because they may have fees and fines that don't allow them to do that for fear of being picked up by the police. These men walk around when you get out of jail with probation and parole fees. So when you leave prison, you don't stop paying your debt. You still have an ongoing debt you're paying. They may have high child support debt. They may have municipal fees that are related to their maybe driving without a license or driving a car with that's not registered. And also, many of these construction jobs may place them on a job on a temporary basis through these temp agencies, but after a certain period of time, they lose that opportunity to stay on that job because they don't want to be hired or can't be hired by those firms based on whatever the policy is around that. So, again, there's a number of issues that are very complex and complicated as to what's going on. And I really do wish I had the magic answer as to what it is. But I have a number of reasons why I think there's not an employment of these men. But I do think a lot of it goes to discriminatory and of practices that are in place.
Now, is this a problem that can be fixed by the city of Milwaukee alone, or are we talking about bigger societal issues here? Maybe the state level for a first stop, maybe society at large looking at problems of incarceration and policing, too.
Yes. I think you hit the nail on the head right there. I think it's not just a community-based and county-based issue. It's a state issue. Wisconsin has unfortunately been seen as one having the worst incarceration rates for Black men in the country. We've been seen as having the worst unemployment rates for Black men in the city of Milwaukee. In fact, a couple of years ago, we were number one in the highest unemployment rates for Black men, except for Detroit and Buffalo, New York. So I think that as a county, as a city, we look pretty bad as it pertains to Black men. But also Madison, Wisconsin has its issues as well, which we haven't talked about. I know Milwaukee's the focus. But, you know, recently there was a big race to equity report that came out that really highlighted the issues of disparity. So the structural issues of race and gender and class need a much bigger discussion than we've heard in the past, particularly as it pertains to a city, a state that has outstanding employment rates and outstanding education rates, but people who are of color are not doing as well for whatever reasons that I think need to be brought out in the public.
So given that you say this is a bigger issue, but at the moment this is a problem that's being laid at Milwaukee's doorstep.
Yes.
What would you have Milwaukee do? What would you recommend?
I think Milwaukee would be it's in a great place to do some things around transitional jobs. I know that Mayor Barrett has talked about traditional jobs. I think we need more of those. I think it would be a great place to also think about how do we do some expungement of people's records and what does that mean? It'd also be a great place to look at some of the debts that men carry around. One of the things that I've been studying at IRP for quite some years has been child support. And what does child support do to people's lives when you have very big debts that accumulate over over time that you can't pay off. And Milwaukee's been very forefront about trying to make some of that happen by having these meetings over all over the city where they do reduce people's debt that they owe to the state, which is an option they have through the federal government, and the state can take that option. Also, I think that we need to really look at what housing is available to men. There are some really good initiatives that are going on in Milwaukee, but I think that if we can deal with the shelter, if we can deal with some of the employment, and also if we can deal with some of the mental health issues that people are confronting on a daily basis from their inability to take care of themselves and their families, I think we would be much further along.
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was David Pate, Associate Professor at the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee and an affiliate of the Institute for Research on Poverty. He joined us to talk about the latest poverty numbers in Milwaukee.
There's a constant seesawing between, quote-unquote, good Asians and bad Asians in America when it comes to the history of their immigration, according to our next guest. Are Asians model immigrants, as they're sometimes portrayed, or are they a threat to America? Depends on the year, the political climate, and the eye of the beholder, says Erica Lee.
Erica is a professor of history at the University of Minnesota and the author of The Making of Asian America. She joins us now to talk about the immigration struggles of Asians in America and to look at the myths and realities about who Asian Americans are today. Erica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
So the story of borders and political turmoil over immigration, it's an old story, and that goes for Asian Americans. And you say that they were the first undocumented immigrants. What was it like for the first groups of Asians to try to enter America?
Right. So Asians have been coming to the United States and to the Americas for centuries, but there was a great immigration debate in the mid-19th century, and it focused on Chinese immigration. And some of the arguments that we hear today about immigrants taking away jobs or not being able to assimilate into American society, or just that there's so many of them, those arguments were used in great force against Chinese immigrants. And as a result, we passed some of the very first restrictive immigration laws in our country's history, the Chinese exclusion laws in the 1880s. And because there was still so much demand for immigrant labor, but these laws prevented most Chinese from coming to the United States, Chinese did what many immigrants have done since then. They found other ways to come to the United States, including simply crossing what then was the unguarded border with Mexico, or using false documentation or even fraudulent identities. So yes, they were the country's very first undocumented immigrants.
And it sounds like there was quite an industry that was built up around getting Chinese people into America for Canadians, for lots of different ethnic groups.
There was a need for labor, but very few opportunities to come. And so there were coyotes or smugglers in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands who would help Chinese navigate the geography and come across the border. There were even some who coached Chinese on passing as Mexicans. So they would dress them in Mexican clothes, teach them a few words of Spanish, and then guide them through some of the areas that they knew the Border Patrol was not looking at.
So you write about that there was talk politically of a fence being insufficient to stem this flow of Chinese, and worry about the moral character of these people coming to America. How would you describe that reaction to Asians in the U.S.?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because I think the stereotype that most Americans have of Asian Americans today are that they're the model minority, that they're the quote-unquote the good immigrants, the ones who are working hard and getting ahead and perhaps even acing the SATs. But go back a century and they essentially were the most despised immigrant group. They were the yellow peril. They were the ones who were causing another race problem in addition to African Americans. And all of those arguments about them not assimilating and just being a threat to the country were very widespread across the political spectrum, first with Chinese and then it extended to other Asian groups that were coming over, Japanese, Koreans, Filipinos, and South Asians.
And so what was the turning point for the immigration policy?
The turning point really had to do a lot with our changing ideas about race, about immigration, but also our changing international relations. So World War II is this fascinating time when, on the one hand, anti-Asian sentiment has really peaked, and we have forcibly removed 120,000 Japanese Americans because we believe that they're loyal to Japan and not to the United States, even though most of them are citizens of the U.S. But at the same time, we're beginning to change our attitudes, our ideas about our new wartime allies of China, India, and the Philippines. And you start seeing in the newspapers this idea that that these immigrants, these are our friends. The Chinese are our friends. They're the good ones. And so the doors open a little bit. And by the 1960s, we do have a real reform in our immigration laws.
And that was the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, right?
It was. It's the last time that our country has passed comprehensive immigration reform, 50 years next month.
And it's interesting because you say that this was incredibly transformative. It transformed all levels of American society, and yet at the time it was underestimated. How come?
It was. You know, American lawmakers were still very concerned. So on the one hand, they agreed that to have a blatantly discriminatory immigration law, including laws that restricted Southern and Eastern Europeans and didn't let them come into the country on the same basis as those from Northern and Western Europe, that was absolutely wrong and that it was an embarrassment in the eyes of the world. And at the time when we're trying to project the message that the United States and capitalism and democracy is better than communism, that this blatantly discriminatory policy was really hurting our international relations. And then the civil rights agenda and reform movements with the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act also prohibited discrimination in American life. So it was, on the one hand, a no-brainer and really an important transformation. But lawmakers were very cautious. They didn't want to open up the United States to floods of immigrants. And so they did place restrictions on immigration and specifically laid out preference categories so that we would welcome primarily those who had family already in the United States and those who had professional skills that the United States needed.
We're talking with Erica Lee right now, professor of history at the University of Minnesota. We're talking about her new book, The Making of Asian America, a History. And Erica, when you watch what's happening now with the Mexican border and this national debate over immigration, what parallels do you see?
There are a lot of parallels historically. So again, a lot of those arguments that were used against Asian immigrants in the early 20th century, we see repeated in relationship to Mexican immigration, and particularly immigration that is undocumented. The numbers for the Latino community, similar to the Asian community, have really been transformed with the 1965 Act, but in different ways. So while the laws really allowed in Asian immigrants with family ties and professional skills, the law also placed restrictions for the very first time on the number of immigrants coming in from the Western Hemisphere. And the backlog of immigrant visas for countries like Mexico that had much more opportunities to come in prior to 1965 has just grown and grown. And that is one of the reasons why we have increased undocumented immigration in the past 50 years.
Now, fast forwarding to today, Asian Americans are sometimes held up, as you say, as model immigrants. They've been portrayed as highly educated, as wealthier, sometimes even happier than other people. What do you make when you hear that kind of statement?
It is really popular in the press. It also mirrors some of the reports about the rise of Asia as well. So on the one hand, it is, you know, one could argue it's a flattering portrait. Certainly, it's seemingly better to be the good model rather than the bad invading immigrant threat. But there's a couple of problems with this idea, and one is that the model minority is highly inaccurate. The Asian American community is really diverse. It makes up 24 different ethnic groups. Some have been in this country for seven generations. Some have recently arrived. They come with different skills. And so we know that Asian Americans are really represented on both extremes of the economic scale. Some are doing quite well, but others struggle in generational poverty, and it's really looking at the data in a broad way that makes it quite clear that the model minority stereotype really doesn't hold up to reality.
And what happens when that is the case, when the qualities of an entire group of people get oversimplified and reduced to a common denominator that might not be true for everybody?
One is that it creates divisions among different groups. It can also increase resentment. So we do see backlash against the idea that there are too many Asians in a certain school or too many Asian doctors, or that both Asian Americans and Asian countries are on the rise and that this is a threat to both Americans and to the U.S. So there are consequences. It also can translate into just the invisibility of Asian Americans and how they're sometimes passed over for social service programs or programs that do work on retention rates for undergraduate students, for example, because the idea is that, oh, Asians are doing fine. They don't need to have the tutoring or the mentoring. So it can be a real problem.
Erica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Erica Lee. She's a professor of history at the University of Minnesota. She joined us to talk about her new book. It's called The Making of Asian America. The Pew Research Center just gave us the numbers to back up what we already know. The vast majority of us have cell phones, and they're with us most of the time.
What isn't so clear is the going standard for when it's okay to use them. So Pew surveyed 3,200 people to find out when they think it's okay to use your cell phone. If we think of etiquette as a form of societal consensus, the survey tried to shed some light on what passes for polite nowadays.
Here to go through some of the findings with us and share her own thoughts is Amy Elgin. She's a science-based syndicated advice columnist and the author of the book, Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Amy, welcome back.
Thank you.
So one finding, the number of us who think it's okay to stare at your phone while you're walking down the street, I guess meaning you're not making eye contact with people, you might fall off the sidewalk, stumble. 80% of people think that that is okay. That's a huge majority. What do you make of that result?
Well, this is why I think it's wrong that we determine etiquette by consensus, because that's just rude. Pull over. It's basically like driving and being on your phone, you know, because you're going to bump into people. And actually, David Carr, who is a late media columnist from the New York Times, he used to just walk head on into people doing that as a form of, I guess, vigilante mannerism.
Well, that opens up a big question. We're in, obviously, this time of change with our technology. We've got all our new stuff. You're suggesting we shouldn't just stumble into an etiquette. We should think this through, it sounds like.
Exactly. So at the root of manners is empathy. Is this thing that I am doing to you going to bother you, hurt you, be very unkind, etc.? And that's what we need to use to guide our cell phone behavior. And the reason we need to do that, cell phones are just so exciting. We are basically like chimps with an info nuke in our hands when we have a cell phone. And so we need to pre-plan not to sort of go with our worst impulses.
So overall, Amy, what did you make of the results of this survey when you looked at what people did and didn't think was okay?
Well, I'm not surprised, because people think what's okay is what they're doing, so they don't have to think poorly of themselves. But I really think that we need to be more thoughtful than that and to be more empathy-directed. For example, you know, to be in a restaurant on a date, on a texting on your phone, I just think that is so terrible. The other person, they have to look into their napkin pretending to be looking for secret messages, because it's so embarrassing to be with the person who's doing that to you.
I've been wondering if maybe the next step in etiquette is if you're going to do this in a certain situation, you're going to look at your smartphone or something, you excuse yourself or say, hey, I'm sorry, I need to look at this thing. Or maybe even, do you mind if I check my messages to see if this important one came in? Does that give us a little bit of an out? We're acknowledging that what we're doing is maybe a bit rude?
Yes, that's very good advice, and I actually advise that. But the thing is, important can't be anything you could possibly get, including spam. important needs to be, my child has a fever, and I need to just make sure that the babysitter says she doesn't need to be hospitalized. You know, or if the liver that you're supposed to install in someone might be arriving soon, that's cool. You know, the other stuff, just this, you know, I got to check the scores, that's mean.
Well, this one should please you then, Amy. Here's some more results from that survey. Phone use during meetings at work, maybe, or a church service or other sort of pay attention types of scenarios. 94% of people said, no, it's not okay. Although I have a hard time believing that 94% of people don't ever do it, too. It's kind of a... What do you think about those results? Encouraging?
No, because I think all those 94% of the people think very highly of themselves and think that, well, I have a reason to do that. The speaker is boring or whatever. And I don't know, you've probably spoken in front of groups. There's nothing worse than looking down and seeing a bunch of people not paying attention. You think, oh, my God, I'm so boring. I should leave. And people don't really think of the human factor like that. How are they making the speaker feel, the preacher feel, whomever feel, who is the audience for their looking down into their little wire?
Well, maybe they're out there transcribing every single word the speaker is saying, and that's a sign of great respect.
Oh, okay. I got that one, too. Tom Zellner, who's a professor at Chapman College, he teaches creative writing there, and he said he can always tell when they're transcribing and when they're on Facebook because they're typing at the wrong time. So people do know what you're doing.
We're talking with Amy Elkin right now, science-based syndicated advice columnist and author of Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F-Word. We're digesting now some findings from the Pew Research Center about when most of us think it's okay or not okay to use our cell phones. And Amy, the survey found that women in particular might be more inclined to use their cell phones as a shield. Let's say someone's coming that they don't want to talk to, they feel put upon, they bury their head in their cell phone, and it's an avoidance tactic. What do you think of that? There are societal pressures sometimes that are particular to women. Is it okay for women to do that?
Well, it depends upon the situation, but I would generally say yes, because what this person's trying to do, probably, maybe, is to be kind so they don't have to blow the person off. They can just pretend to be otherwise engaged. And this notion that honesty is the best policy, sometimes deception is a better policy because it's kinder.
Another result, a lot of people said it's okay to use that cell phone, look at your smartphone, do stuff when you're on public transportation, riding a bus, a subway for the places that have subways. And this is one I think I'm behind that. It's no different than if I sit and read a book on a bus or something like that. Are you okay with that one, Amy?
Oh, sure. People have this weird prejudice. Oh, my God, it's new technology. How terrible. In fact, a woman argued, what did she say? It's antisocial to be on your phone when you're walking down the street. And maybe you're talking to somebody who's more important to you than whatever the current environment is. So I call that multisocial and think people should be a little less quick to judge other people's behavior when they don't really know what is going on.
On the other hand, that is something we hear a lot about, we talk a lot about on this radio station, about whether as a society we're getting less inclined to engage with each other. And some research shows that when we just smile at someone on the street, we get happier, they get happier. But if everyone's on their phone, I guess maybe nobody's happier. Are there risks involved with that?
Well, yes, we do have to pre-plan, because you have to think about your phone, have an engaged relationship with it, and think about, do I really want to be on my phone all the time, or might I have some wonderful experiences if I engage? However, not everybody likes to engage. My boyfriend is an introvert. We get to a party, and he'll say, do we really have to go inside? And for people like that, it's wonderful to be able to cocoon themselves, to not have to engage with people all the time, because they get, it's sort of painful for them.
Here's another etiquette issue that I've encountered on a bus or hanging out at a restaurant or something like that, when somebody else is talking on their cell phone and I get deep insight to the rich inner life, their plans, their legal troubles, their family lawsuits. So how do we handle that issue as the talker, and can we intervene if we're the talkee, if we're the bystander there?
It depends. I call this privatizing public space as your own. It is the height of rudeness. People don't realize this, however. I'm going to give you a little science on this. It turns out that a one-sided conversation is more interruptive to the brain than a two-sided one through something called theory of mind, which is our theory of what's in other people's minds. So, for example, if a guy kneels down across the street to ask something of his girlfriend, he's probably not asking her for a pen. And we know this, but this ability to identify what other people are probably thinking is automatic, and that preys on us when people are on their phone calls. However, the problem is, if you try to control people, if you try to criticize them, this tends to backfire. Criticizing people does not make them change. It makes them want to clobber you. So the best things to do are to say things like, it's a little loud, or would you mind keeping it down a little? You know, and to not be aggressive and just say, you're so rude, get off your phone, because they're not going to do that. They're going to do whatever they were doing loudly and more profanely than they were.
See, I'm in the minority. I love listening to people's conversations on the phone. It is so interesting. It's a boon to writers, and it makes the bus ride shorter. I mean, they might just be some faceless stranger, but then you know they have a big medical appointment coming up. They had a fight with their spouse. It's so interesting.
In important regards, you and I are very different people.
Yeah, you hear more interesting people than I do. I was at a store the other day. I mean, people are just arranging the times to do things. Got to pick up the dry cleaning when I get home. Wow, fascinating.
Yeah, no, you can't always argue for the content, but sometimes there's good stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe if I could pretend like I was Bob Newhart and I'm filling in the comedian and filling in the other side in humorous ways in my mind, I guess then I could find it more entertaining.
And I do want to answer something you sort of brought up, but maybe it was about restaurants and things, but in the movies, people who are on their cell phones, they know they're being rude and they don't care. So you have to call in a professional. You have to call an usher, because if you tell them to please not do it, they already know they're doing it and don't care. So you're just, it's a futile act on your part.
Outside intervention needed. Good point. Well, we're talking now to science-based advice columnist Amy Alkan about a new Pew study that looked at how people use their cell phones these days. We're getting a snapshot on what does and doesn't pass as good etiquette in the smartphone era.
And we want to hear from you about this. When do you think it is never, ever okay to use your phone? Where do you draw the line? And when have you been most recently irate at someone for misusing their phone at the wrong time? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking to advice columnist Amy Alkan about a new Pew study that looks at how people use their cell phones today. We're getting a snapshot of what does and doesn't pass for good etiquette, what's acceptable these days. Amy's the author of the book Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are the rules for you? What bugs you when it comes to public cell phone use? Maybe at the dinner table in a public place. Call 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Jordan on the line in Milwaukee. Jordan, hi.
Hi. I just want to say, for me, the worst was when I rode public transportation. Thank God I don't do that anymore. But when I rode public transportation, the worst was when people would play music on their cell phones without headphones.
Ah, okay. So you're not talking, they're listening quietly to themselves on headphones. They're politely sharing their music with their co-passengers.
Yes, like, you know, blaring their music so that you hear it all throughout the bus. And it's like, you know, I don't want to hear, you know, your bad music. I've got bad taste in music. We've all got bad taste in music. I'm sure you don't want to hear my Fleetwood Mac and my sisters blaring. So, you know, politely and kindly, please, you know, get some headphones.
Jordan, thanks a lot for that call. And Amy, can we ever break the chain, if I can quote Fleetwood Mac, on playing music loudly on public transit?
Oh, my God, he is so right. Other passengers' eardrums should not be considered shared space. And in terms of the empathy thing I was discussing before about empathy being the root of manners, one thing that we all can do is to do a little test of our headphones to see if they're leaky. That horrible mosquito sound of leaky headphones, angry mosquitoes, to see if that's the case. I mean, you could spend another $10 on your headphones and get a pair that don't leak, because you're probably on public transportation torturing people simply by existing, so you don't need to give them any sound effects to go with.
Jordan, thanks a lot for that call. We're going to go next to Todd in Cross Plains. Todd, hi.
Hi. One thing that really bothered me, I've bartended in the past, right? And there's nothing more annoying than when someone walks up to the bar and they're talking on the phone and they wave to you to come on over to them. I didn't, when I was bartending, I didn't wait on people. I'd wait till they hung up, and they'd usually be upset, and I'd tell them, well, I figured you were on the phone, so I didn't want to interrupt your conversation.
I love that. And you know what? That's right on, because when you let yourself be abused, that opens you up to more and more of it. It is good to tell them so they don't just think that you're rude, to say, I'll get to you when you're off the phone, so they realize, and they're more likely to hop to it then. But really, it's great that you did that, because people need to be trained.
That's right. It's interesting, Amy, that you're promoting that rude does not answer rude. So you should still behave well, even if someone else maybe is not.
Right, because what you don't want to do is let other people create who you are, create your behavior. So that's why, again, it's so important to pre-plan, because we are basically, we are chimps. We're basically these hot-headed people, hot-headed creatures, and we're liable to get all upset at these situations. And instead, what you need to do is just expect that other people will behave rudely. Then you won't be so mad. And then when they do, you can handle it in a cool way.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. Jenny is with us next in Rice Lake. Jenny, hi.
I think mine is very similar to your last call. I work in a convenience store, and when they will not put down their cell phone, they will not listen to what I'm saying, they will not pay, they will not do anything until, and they just continue talking. I, as a matter of fact, one time pounded on the counter to get their attention, and it was just ridiculous. And the other customers behind, not only is it rude to me, but the other customers in line get very angry, and they say, why don't you tell them? And I said, I can't, because I work here. I said, but you could tell them. I said, I can't stop you. And one gentleman, a woman was texting, and when he got up to pay, he said, oh, wait a minute, let me get out my cell phone and text a while. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But that, to me, should never happen. You can put your phone down long enough to pay for your purchase.
And Jenny, thanks for the call. Amy, a retail store I used to work at has since posted a sign at the register that says, we won't serve you if you're talking on your cell phone. I don't know if they've amended it to include texting since then yet, though. Should stores have that be a posted policy?
Oh, please, if you're a store owner listening out there, please have that be your policy and support your employees. Otherwise, they're just victimized. They need their job. They can't say what they should say, which is, I'll help the next person who's not all busy on their phone, because that's the fair thing to them. We should not treat cashiers as these sort of machines with realistic human features. And I learned something in France, and you go through a courtyard of a building, and some woman you have never seen before and will never see again says, bonjour, madame. And that's really nice, and I incorporated that. I'm from the Midwest, from Michigan, across the lake. And, I was raised to be decent and friendly. And so now I always talk to cashiers, hi, how are you? God, it's crowded. Hope you're not having a hard day. They really appreciate this, instead of being treated like a thing.
We're talking with Amy Alkin right now, science-based syndicated advice columnist. She's the author of Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Talking about a new survey from Pew that tells us when people feel it is okay or not okay to use their cell phone. For instance, is it okay to grab your phone and take pictures of stuff in public when you're with other people? Survey says 60% of people do that. They think it's okay. What do you say, Amy?
Well, it really depends. We should not assume that other people's privacy belongs to us, because it does not. Not everybody wants to be in your photo. Now, if you're in a public place, you have a First Amendment right to take pictures. But as for whether you can post mean things, which many people do, about total strangers, if they're a private person, would you like that to happen to you? There's sort of some simple thoughts that we can go through on that. And I do want to say it is a big problem for restaurants where people do these elaborate food shots. First of all, if you're in some dimly lit, fabulous place, your cell phone flashing is not part of the ambiance that they intend. That ruins it for other people, but also it really slows things down for the kitchen, and it makes their business not as profitable, because it actually does take quite a long time for people often to get through their phone shots of their food, and they'll back their elbow into another patron. It's kind of awful.
We'll go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Margaret on the line in Milwaukee. Margaret, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. This is maybe a little bit of a different annoyance than what you're talking about, but I get really annoyed when people expect me to answer my phone because I have it with me.
That is a great point. Technology, the ability to answer your phone immediately does not mean it's a mandate. And people need to let other people know their phone policy so they won't be offended. I also will not answer my phone much of the time. It's always on silent if it's with me. If I'm out with someone, I focus on them. So you need to let people know that and just let them know it's policy and that it doesn't have anything to do with them. They can't just expect you to behave in a way that works for them.
Amy, do you think that where we are right now with this technology is sort of equivalent to the Wild West, that anything goes? We're just figuring this stuff out now, that maybe 5 years from now, maybe 3 years from now, maybe things will have calmed down a little. Maybe people will be a little less intrusive with their phones.
Yes, I really think that's true. And it sort of mirrors what happened with the telephone. Initially, people really didn't know what they were supposed to do. And in fact, Alexander Graham Bell had tried to set up some rules, like that you would answer not hello, but ahoy. It's really weird and never, thankfully, caught on. But I do think that we will start to have pressure the same way we did about people shouting into their phones in public, which you really don't hear as much of anymore, that we will start to have better behavior in texting. For example, in workplaces, some workplaces, and I do suggest this in the book, they have a basket in the middle of the table when they have a meeting, because people are just too tempted to, I'll just check that one thing on Facebook, Cakes or Us or whatever, you know, and they're not paying attention to the person who's talking. So basically the meeting was worthless to some degree. And so that needs to be, things like that need to be thought of to work within human behavior and the bratty ways we behave.
Amy, thanks so much for joining us. Informative, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, I love talking to you guys.
That was Amy Alkin. She's a science-based syndicated advice columnist and author of the book Good Manners for Nice People Who Sometimes Say the F Word. Still time for you to weigh in over at the Central Time Facebook page. Have you been an offender? Have you used your cell phone in a way and thought, you know what, in hindsight, I shouldn't do that? Or, and you're more likely to answer it this way, what bothers you when other people do it? Head over to the Central Time Facebook page.